I'm especially excited to share with you this morning. I always look forward to doing that, but this morning is special because I get to share the message time with Andrew Herman. He's going to be helping me out this morning, and he's been working, if you don't know Andrew, he's been working with our students in the youth ministry since the fall, and he's been doing an awesome job spending time with our students and mentoring them and investing into them. And I love working with him. I've really been enjoyed getting to prepare this message time with him as well. Now we're going to get to the mirror and what Bailey is doing with it, but first I want to tell you a story, okay? I want to tell you a story. In 1973, this guy named Jan Erik Olsen tried to rob a bank. This is Jan. And it did not go well. Things did not go well for him, and it kind of got messy, and he ended up taking four of the bank employees hostage. And so they holed up in one of the bank vaults for 6 days while police figured out a way to rescue them. And they did. Eventually, they drilled a hole down through the top of the bank vault, and they dropped tear gas in there, and it drove Jan and the hostages out. And all the hostages were safely freed without any serious injuries. But here's what makes the case so interesting. So after the hostages were freed, they refused to testify against Olsen in court. Not only that, but they began raising money for his defense, the same hostages that he had kept there in the bank vault. You see, those 6 days where they were captive in that vault changed the hostages. Even though Olsen was using their lives as a bargaining chip for money, they began to appreciate him. They started to agree that his demands were reasonable, and they wanted him to go free. Now, that bank was in Stockholm, Sweden. You may recognize that name because that's where we get the term Stockholm Syndrome from, is this case right here. And Stockholm Syndrome is this condition where captives form bonds with their captors. You can go online and look up these crazy examples of what happens in cases of Stockholm Syndrome. You know, some people keep a picture of their former captor in their wallet at all times. There have even been people who later rejoin up with their captors and help them commit similar crimes to the ones that they were involved in. And Stockholm Syndrome demonstrates something that we really need to understand about captivity, and that's that it can warp us and it can change us. And when we're captured and we're fed a stream of lies, we may just start to believe those lies. Now, this morning, we are kind of wrapping up a look at the book of Daniel. Back in October and December, I got to share a little bit about Daniel. And we saw that Daniel is a book about captivity in the kingdom of Babylon. And so for a quick refresher course, the kingdom of Babylon is this powerful, wealthy, beautiful, and advanced kingdom. It's also very violent. And Babylon comes down to the smaller kingdom of Judah, and they destroy it. They wipe it out, they reduce it to rubble, even God's temple is destroyed. And amidst the ruin and death, Babylon looks out and they see potential in the ruins of Judah. And so they leave the best and brightest Judeans alive and they take them back to Babylon for re-education. And so these Judeans that are taken captive back to Babylon, they learn the Babylonian languages. And they adopt Babylonian values. They're even given new Babylonian names. Their old names are done away with. And they leave behind their silly, ignorant, backwater beliefs and values that they used to have back in Judah. Essentially, they're brainwashed. And four of those Jews that were taken were Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And we get to see in the book of Daniel how they deal with this re-education, how they handle being captives of Babylon surrounded by a culture that is averse to their own values. Because remember, captivity can change us so that we want what our captors want, believe what they believe. We value what's important to them. We may even begin to look and to act like them. And so today we brought this mirror. Because our example of captivity today is not a kidnapping victim from history. Our example of captivity this morning is you. And it's me. We are captives of Babylon. Now, I know, you know, Babylon, it's just in the Old Testament, right? And by the time the New Testament is written, Babylon has been virtually deserted. It's kind of this desert town. But then, in the book of Revelation, in chapter 17, if you want to look at it, Babylon shows up again. They're at the very end of the New Testament. And Babylon is portrayed as this woman who has corrupted all the various kingdoms and powers and cultures of the earth. You see, Babylon comes to represent more than just a place. It's a philosophy, it's a culture, it's a way of thinking. It is the power of our culture to feed us lies that we may believe. And that's what this mirror is about. In the book Invitation to a Journey by Robert Mulholland, he says this. He says, everyone is in a process of spiritual formation. We are being shaped into either the wholeness of the image of Christ or horribly destructive caricature of that image. Bailey is writing a bunch of lies on this mirror. And it is the goal of Babylon to ensure that when you look into the mirror, you don't see the image of Christ staring back, but instead you see yourself reflecting all the lies and misshapen values that Babylon has been telling you are true. And you've heard these lies. You're familiar with them. They're lies like busyness is a sign of importance. And so we fill up our schedules. We talk about how pressed for time we are so that others will think we're valuable, that we're doing something meaningful. But Scripture, it paints a different picture of busyness. You know, Jesus was constantly looking for ways to get away from the busyness just to be with God. God institutes the Sabbath in part for the Israelites because he knows that we have a tendency to search for meaning and value in our work rather than in our relationship with him. How about the lie, romantic love is the ultimate fulfillment? And maybe you've heard this lie if you've ever seen a movie or listened to a song or read a book, right? Romantic love is the ultimate fulfillment is a lie that runs through our almost every story that we tell as a culture. And the truth is that romantic love isn't the ultimate fulfillment. Knowing the love of God is the ultimate fulfillment. And the reason that romantic love feels so good and gives us butterflies and we tell all these stories about it is because it's a dim reflection of God's greater love. And romantic love is supposed to point us toward him and his all-encompassing perfect love. And the truth is that if we expect romantic love to bring us ultimate fulfillment, it will always fail and buckle under that pressure. It can't do it. We'll be left disappointed and heartbroken. How about this lie? Do whatever makes you happy. Now that sounds good. I mean, it makes some sense, right? If I want to be happy, then I'll just do what makes me happy. But first, your personal happiness may actually be a pretty shallow goal to aim for. But maybe more importantly for this morning, we tend to be poor judges of what actually will make us happy. Jeremiah 17:9 tells us the heart is deceitful above all things. The truth is that all the time we desire things and we chase after things that are bad for us, that only bring pain and misery to ourselves and those around us. And so following what I think will make me happy will oftentimes lead to the exact opposite. How about this lie? You only matter if others notice you. This lie motivates us to do so many crazy things. You only matter if others notice you. From parents who will throw, you know, $3,000 birthday parties for their children in order to impress their peers, to students who gauge their worth and rate their experience based on how many likes their pictures get. If the opinion of others determines your value, you will spend your whole life trying to please others and end up with nothing in the end. Here's a powerful lie. What you watch doesn't affect who you are. What a powerful lie. If no one knows what I'm watching on my phone in private, it isn't hurting anyone else. But it is. What we consume determines who we become. And when we watch things that devalue other human beings, we begin to devalue them. We begin to objectify them and treat them as less than bearers of God's image. And then there's the old classic lie. If everyone does it, can't be that bad, right? And you know these lies that Bailey's writing down. In fact, if we asked around the room this morning, we could probably fill up 100 mirrors with the lies we have heard in our culture. And Babylon wants you to buy in to these lies, to believe them so much that instead of reflecting the image of Jesus to others, you reflect a distorted system of values. And so today, we're going to go back to the early days of Babylon in Daniel 6, and we're going to take a look at a guy who totally and completely buys into all the lies. In fact, this guy buys in so much that even though he's the ruler of Babylon in name, he actually becomes just another captive.
So So I know that some of you can probably see your image, right? Your reflection in the mirror. And some of you can probably see other people's reflection in the mirror. And I know what you're thinking. U-G-L-Y, you ain't got no alibi, you're ugly. Yeah, you're ugly. Right, you know, you always hear these types of chants at basketball games or other sporting events, and like they really just make me wonder, like, what's the purpose? Like, how did that come about? You know, it really doesn't make sense except for that it rhymes, and you can say it in a chant, right? Well, this morning we're going to be looking at a guy that is really U-G-L-Y with no alibi. You know, Daniel in the Lion's Den is a story that we are all familiar with. You know, our Sunday school teachers would get out their storybook Bibles and their felt people, and they would tell the story of God heroically saving Daniel by closing the mouths of the lions. You know, I think we do a great job at looking at two of our main characters, right? We have God and we have Daniel, but so often we forget another main character, and that's King Darius. You know, it's important that we realize who King Darius is because this story is really written from his perspective. So to understand the full value of the story, we need to understand who he was. And the last time we looked at Daniel, we looked at King Nebuchadnezzar. Well, King Nebuchadnezzar is no longer king, and so we now have moved on to Belshazzar. And Belshazzar is the ruler that experienced the famous writing on the wall in chapter 5 of Daniel. And the writing on the wall told Belshazzar that his days were numbered and that Babylon would be handed over to the Medes and the Persians. And, you know, it's important to note that the Medes and the Persians were really a brutal people. You know, the book of Daniel is split off into two sections. We have the narrative and we have the prophecy. And in the prophecy of Daniel, the Medes and the Persians were seen as a two-horned ram that charged towards the west and the north and the south. No animal could stand against it, and none could rescue from its power. It did as it pleased and became great. And you can see that there in chapter 8, verse 4. So, you know, nothing was going to stand in the way of the Medes and the Persians on their conquest for power. And Babylon became one of their victims. In verses 30 and 31 of chapter 5, it says, that very night Belshazzar was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So, you know, we've made it, right? We've made it to King Darius, Darius the Mede. You know, he came to power, right, through this death and destruction, and it was something that he was proud about. You know, these are the values, this power and pride are the values that Babylon has stressed so heavily for Darius. And now King Darius gets to look in his mirror and he sees these new found power and pride. You know, these are things that he wanted for so long and they're now finally his. You know, honestly, that's the whole premise of captivity, right? Babylon told Darius about all the things it could give him and he admired and desired them from afar. And he worked so hard to become what Babylon wanted him to be. And he did it. When he looks in the mirror now, he now sees what Babylon wanted for him. And he has become Babylon's spitting image. You know, it's really ironic because King Darius thought that he had conquered Babylon, when the reality is he's just another captive. He's become exactly what Babylon wanted him to be. So we see in verse 1 of chapter 6 that King Darius was pleased to set officials over the kingdom. And Daniel was one of those officials that he set out for the kingdom. And he was the top official. And you know, King Darius loved and respected Daniel. We see in verse 3 of chapter 6 that Daniel was seen as a man with an excellent spirit. And I'm sure that that was recognized by King Darius. But the other officials really weren't too pleased with the way that Daniel came to power. And they didn't want to just undermine him or take him out of authority, but they wanted him killed. And the other officials knew of King Darius's pride, and they knew that he would stay faithful to himself while Daniel would stay faithful to God. So they used that and played that to their advantage. And they went to King Darius and they pleaded and said, "Make a decree in which no man can pray to any other god or man but you, King Darius, or they'd be thrown into the lion's den." And of course, because King Darius found his identity in his power and pride, he signed the decree and set it into action. And of course, Daniel was then caught praying. We see in verse 10 and 11 where it says, "When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he had done previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and plea before his God." Daniel knew the document had been signed. He couldn't plead ignorant. So the other officials returned to King Darius and told him about what Daniel had done. And honestly, this is one of the big turning points for King Darius. The power and the pride that King Darius had now found his identity in is now what is going to hurt him the most. Right? I mean, we have Daniel, this man with an excellent spirit, loved and respected by King Darius, now faces the ultimate reality of death because of King Darius. We read in verse 14 where it says, "Then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel, and he labored till the sun went down to rescue him." Right? So now the powerful man labored, and the prideful man is now distressed. In verse 16, it says, "The king declared to Daniel, 'May your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you.'" There was nothing that King Darius could do. He was hopeless. He was helpless. He could not save Daniel. You know, and the image that he wanted for himself for so long is now failing him. So UGLY, he ain't got no alibi. The image and the values that Babylon wants for us, that Babylon tells us are so important, are all just lies. And you know, that's honestly what King Darius is realizing now. You know, if we look into the lies that Babylon tells us, our mirror tends to look a lot like King Darius's mirror. And, you know, with a mirror like this, it looks so nice at the beginning. I am clothed with power. I am clothed with pride. But really, it's just what made him ugly. You know, I think that mirrors are honestly a pretty cool tool, right? You know, we stand in front of them to look presentable before we go out to the rest of society. And, you know, I honestly think that we are overly obsessed with mirrors in the way that we look, which honestly in itself is one of Babylon's lies. But we have to begin to realize that far more important than our outward reflection is the reflection of our hearts. You know, earlier Jeremy mentioned of how we are reflecting Christ's image or a horribly destructive caricature of that image. So maybe we should care for the reflection of our hearts with the same urgency that we care for the reflection of our physical appearance. So, you know, this honestly invites us to ask ourselves, what makes you ugly? Or what are you tempted then to write on your mirror? Is your ugliness your pride? You know, you don't want to break away from a certain sin because your outside image is much more valuable than your inside heart. Or is it people-pleasing? You do things so that people can see your goodness over the goodness of God. Is it pleasure, right? Do you seek after idols such as social media, lust, the right clothing brands, the right neighborhood, the best car, over the full relationship that comes with Christ? Or is it perfectionism? You know, what you do is never enough, so you don't try anything at all, or you exhaust yourself on one small, simple task. So what makes you ugly? Now, we know what it is for Darius, and in verse 16, he begins to recognize that too. Let's turn back there to verse 16, where it says, "The king declared to Daniel, 'May your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you.'" Darius can't save Daniel. Darius knows he can't save Daniel. And when Darius realizes this, he recognizes that God is the only one that can. And he does, right? This is the familiar part of the story. God heroically closes the mouths of the lions and saves Daniel. And when King Darius goes and checks on Daniel the next morning and he hears Daniel's voice, this is one of my favorite reactions of the works of God in the Old Testament. And it's this, in verse 23, it says, "King Darius was exceedingly glad." So, you know, the mistaken values that King Darius had bought into are nothing compared to the exceeding gladness that comes from a rescue from God. And the values that Babylon places on us that tells us are so good and will bring us so much joy are all just lies. Because just like King Darius, when we need them most, they will fail us. And I mean, that's it, right? King Darius realizes that Babylon's lies are failing him. You know, at the beginning of our story, right, King Darius thinks that he has conquered Babylon with his power. But what he is now realizing is that the true king, God, who has all true power, is king over all and has conquered Babylon. And that's when Darius makes this new decree, giving glory to God. It says, "For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions." All of this making God's name known.
You know, if the two main characters of Daniel and the Lion's Den are Daniel and Darius, I would much rather see myself as Daniel in the story, right? If they're the two people we can relate to, I'd rather be the guy who doesn't hesitate, he never gives in, and he ignores the lies of Babylon. You know, the guy who keeps his mirror clean, and he reflects the image of God, the image God has intended for him to share with others. But I think the truth is that most of the time, I'm probably closer to Darius, right? I constantly need to reorient myself. I need to see the lies of Babylon for what they are. I need to spend time in Scripture to be reminded of what is actually true. And it's this constant struggle to make sure that I don't let Babylon ruin, taint my reflection. So I've got to ask, how does Daniel do it? I mean, doesn't he make it look easy in the text? Why is it that he can so consistently resist the influence of Babylon and stay faithful to God? Well, turn over a page maybe to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. As Andrew noted earlier, the book of Daniel is kind of broken into two sections. And then the first six chapters have this more narrative storytelling structure. And the last six chapters of Daniel break away. And they record these visions that God gives Daniel concerning things happening in his own time and in the future. And there's a lot of symbolic imagery here. And it can be a little confusing, honestly. And chapter 7 really is no exception to that. In chapter 7, Daniel has this dream about four beasts coming up out of the sea. And the first is like a lion with eagle's wings. Then there's this bear with ribs in its mouth. There's a four-headed leopard with four wings on its back. And then finally, there's this terrifying beast with iron teeth and ten horns. And one of the horns has a mouth and starts talking. It gets a little confusing. And Daniel actually gets the chance to ask an angel about it all in verse 16. And the angel explains that each beast represents a great kingdom that will rise up in the coming years. And it's really kind of amazing because we can look through and identify these kingdoms pretty easily. The lion represents the first Babylonian kingdom. Then the bear is the coming of the Medes and the Persians. After that, the leopard comes and represents Greece. And then the great and terrifying beast is Rome. And in Daniel's dream, he then sees God take his seat on the throne. And there's like fire and light coming out from the throne. And each of these kingdoms is judged and their power is taken away. But what I really want us to notice this morning is there in chapter 7, verses 13 through 14. After Daniel sees all this, he sees this. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Daniel sees the coming of the Son of Man. And that title may ring a bell, because it's the same title that Jesus uses to refer to himself when he comes to earth. When Jesus shows up, he says, "I'm the one. I'm the Son of Man. I'm the one that Daniel saw coming, and I'm bringing an eternal kingdom." And the final piece of this puzzle, as we understand how Daniel was able to stay faithful, comes in verse 1 of chapter 7, where it tells us that this vision Daniel has actually occurs during the reign of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, before Darius came and took power. And so the vision that you read about in chapter 7 actually happens before Daniel is ever faced with the lion's den of chapter 6. And so this is why Daniel can resist Babylon, because before he comes up against Babylon's lies, he already knows that Babylon's power is fading. He already knows that Babylon's days are numbered and a new kingdom is coming. The Son of Man is going to bring an eternal kingdom. And so Daniel says, "Forget Babylon. I'm going to live for that next kingdom. I'm going to live for that eternal one." And so as Babylon throws lies at Daniel, just like it does for all of us, he doesn't give them the time of day. You know, he says, "Why would I buy into Babylon's values when I know it's on its way out? I'm looking forward to something better. God is doing something better, something eternal, and I want to be part of that." And here's the incredible news for us. We get to see it. We get to see it in action today. You know, Daniel resisted Babylon's influence because he was looking forward to something better. But we know that Jesus has come. His kingdom is already breaking into the world, and we are part of it. So we too can say no to Babylon's values, because we know Babylon is already on its way out. I mean, why would we want to reflect lies when we can reflect the image of Christ? Peter actually lays out this exact line of thinking in 1 Peter 1, 10 through 16. He starts off in verse 10 by telling us that the prophets, people like Daniel, they longed for the day that Jesus was coming. They looked forward to Jesus coming with great anticipation. I'm going to pick up reading in verse 12 of 1 Peter 1. "It was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves but you when they spoke of the things that have now been told you by those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven. Even angels long to look into these things. Therefore," and you could circle that "therefore," because what he's saying is, therefore, because you get to experience what they, the prophets and Daniel, looked forward to, "then with minds that are alert and fully sober, set your hope on the grace to be brought to you when Jesus Christ is revealed at his coming. As obedient children, do not conform to the evil desires you had when you lived in ignorance." That's don't buy into Babylon's lies, right? "But just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do. For it is written, 'Be holy because I am holy.'" Daniel wasn't Superman. He wasn't born with more spiritual fortitude. He just knew that Babylon was already dying. And he wanted to be part of the eternal kingdom that the Son was bringing. And we know that too. And so we can shrug off Babylon's lies. We can live a life that reflects Jesus to others. We can say there's a better way of life than living at the mercy of your culture, your captor. Come instead and be part of the Son's eternal kingdom. And that's a real invite. That's a real invite today. If you aren't part of Jesus' kingdom, you can be today. If you're tired of carrying all these lies around, of chasing things that will never bring what they promise, Jesus says that life following him is easy and light. Or if your mirror is full of mistakes and false promises, and maybe you can't even remember who you might have once looked like, Jesus says, that's okay. We can fix that. I can wipe that clean. I died so that my blood can wash away your sins. And so if you see Babylon's lies when you look in the mirror and you're ready instead to follow Jesus, we would absolutely love to help you with that this morning. Or if you would like to pray with someone, there are people in the back who would love to do that as well. They'll be waiting in the back to pray with you. We are going to stand together and celebrate Jesus' victory over Babylon and sing about the joy we have from being part of his eternal kingdom. If we can help you in any way, let us know as we sing.